These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.
Today on Writers on a New England Stage, Tommy Orange's debut novel, There, There. It's a sweeping collection of interconnected stories told from the rarely heard perspective of urban Indians, a cast of characters at once displaced and very much at home in Oakland, California.
We know the sound of the freeway better than we do rivers, the howl of distant trains better than wolf howls. We know the smell of gas and freshly wet concrete and burned rubber better than we do the smell of cedar or sage or even fry bread, which isn't traditional, like reservations aren't traditional, but nothing is original. Everything comes from something that came before, which was once nothing. Everything is new and doomed.
I'm Peter Biello, and today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth with debut novelist and national bestseller Tommy Orange. Hear our conversation after the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Louise Schiavone. The Labor Department is reporting considerably more robust job growth than anticipated, 224,000 jobs created in June, the overall unemployment rate fractionally higher at 3.7%. NPR's Chris Arnold reports.
The report was much stronger than expected. Economists were predicting a gain of 165,000 jobs. And this report follows a much weaker than expected one a month ago. So these latest numbers will be a relief to those that were seeing signs in the jobs report that the economy was starting to stumble. In terms of what workers are getting paid, wage gains have been weakening the past few months. Average hourly earnings rose by 3.1%, which is the same as the month before and down a bit from this past winter. Construction, manufacturing, and healthcare all saw job gains. Chris Arnold, NPR News.
Lots of tourists, lots of rain, but a minimum of partisanship at President Trump's 4th of July celebration on the nation's armed forces on the National Mall. Ellie Yu from member station WAMU was there and described the scene for NPR's Morning Edition.
Closer to the Lincoln Memorial where the president was speaking, there were, you know, people were cheering. That was where there was a ticketed VIP section, and people who were supporters of the president were closer to the memorial itself. But further in the back where I was, I mean, there were just people who weren't necessarily paying a whole lot of attention to the speech per se. They were watching the flyovers. I mean, some people were saluting as the military aircraft flew over. But most people had their cell phones up in the air just documenting the whole thing.
President Trump leaves the White House later this morning for his golf resort in Bedminster, New Jersey. This afternoon, Houston will host its second Democratic primary candidates forum in just over 2 months. Andrew Schneider of Houston Public Media reports the National Education Association is hosting the event as the centerpiece of its annual assembly.
Roughly 10,000 delegates will attend the Strong Public Schools Presidential Forum taking place at Houston's George R. Brown Convention Center. NEA President Lily Eskelson Garcia says all questions for the candidates have come from members of the public.
There is absolutely nothing we could think of that was more important than making sure that we do our civic duty and take a look at all of those folks that are saying they want to be the next president of the United States.
The 10 confirmed participants include former Vice President Joe Biden and Senators Kamala Harris, Elizabeth Warren, and Bernie Sanders. For NPR News, I'm Andrew Schneider in Houston.
The West Coast is braced for potential aftershocks after the strongest earthquake in 20 years shook Southern California and parts of Nevada yesterday morning. The 6.4 magnitude quake struck in the middle of the morning. Its effects felt mostly in the town of Ridgecrest, California, about 150 miles northeast of Los Angeles. This is NPR. The United Nations is calling on Venezuela to act immediately to stop what it calls grave human rights violations. NPR's Philip Reeves says multiple abuses are detailed in scathing new report by the head of the UN's Human Rights Agency.
The UN's human rights chief, Michelle Bachelet, visited Venezuela last month and came back with some damning findings. Her report says there's been a shocking number of extrajudicial killings by the security forces there, more than 5,200 last year, according to official Venezuelan government numbers. Officials from the government of President Nicolas Maduro claim these were people resisting arrest. Yet UN investigators interviewed relatives of 20 of the dead, who described how police special forces in masks broke into their homes, forced women to strip, and separated men from the family before shooting them. Witnesses said the police then doctored the scene to make it look as if the victim offered resistance. Philip Reeves, NPR News.
Amid the uncertainty of Britain's post-Brexit economy, there's positive news from Jaguar Land Rover. The company has announced plans to manufacture a range of electric cars in the UK. The all-electric version of the Jaguar XJ sedan will be made in Castle Bromwich in central England. The plant will close for 6 weeks for retooling. A lightning strike at a 4th of July gathering in South Carolina left one man dead and several hurt. A witness said the partiers had been boating on a nearby river, had gone ashore for a barbecue when lightning struck a tree and ran through several of the people gathered. I'm Louise Schiavone, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include the Kresge Foundation, expanding opportunities in America's cities through grant-making and social investing. More at kresge.org. And the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation at macfound.org.
I'm Peter Biello, and today, NHPR and the Music Hall present Writers on a New England Stage with Cheyenne and Arapaho author Tommy Orange to talk about his novel that follows the struggles of a dozen Native Americans living in Oakland, California. Tommy Orange's 2018 novel, There, There, has been hailed as an astonishing literary debut by Margaret Atwood and has won the National Book Critics Circle Award and the 2019 Hemingway Foundation Pen Award. Here's Tommy Orange as he stepped on stage at the Music Hall in Portsmouth.
So I thought of the idea for this novel at the end of 2010, right after finding out I was going to be a father, and didn't start writing into it until the beginning of 2012 because I was becoming a father and still working full-time. And so that first year, all the characters that I'm going to read from tonight, they came out the first year, along with a lot of other characters that never made it past the first year. But this piece of writing that I'm going to read to you came out the first year, and it's not all of it, but part of what still exists in the book. I read to those Native youth that night, and they were really moved by it because it felt like it was speaking to their experience. And that really gave me a lot of energy to keep going on the novel because to reach them, as I said, it's not easy to. And so the fact that I did, I think, kept me writing for years after. This is from the prologue. There's all these subtitles to the sections of the prologue. This is called Urbanity. Urban Indians were the generation born in the city. We've been moving for a long time, but the land moves with you like memory. An urban Indian belongs to the city, and cities belong to the earth. Everything here is formed in relation to every other living and non-living thing from the earth, all our relations. The process that brings anything to its current form, chemical, synthetic, technological, or otherwise, doesn't make the product not a product of the living earth. Buildings, freeways, cars, are these not of the earth? Were they shipped in from Mars, the moon? Is it because they're processed, manufactured, or that we handle them? Are we so different? Were we at one time not something else entirely, Homo sapiens, single-celled organisms, space dust, unidentifiable pre-bang quantum theory? Cities form in the same way as galaxies. Urban Indians feel at home walking in the shadow of a downtown building. We came to know the downtown Oakland skyline better than we did any sacred mountain range, the redwoods in the Oakland hills better than any other deep wild forest. We know the sound of the freeway better than we do rivers, the howl of distant trains better than wolf howls. We know the smell of gas and freshly wet concrete and burned rubber better than we do the smell of cedar or sage or even fry bread, which isn't traditional, like reservations aren't traditional, but nothing is original. Everything comes from something that came before, which was once nothing. Everything is new and doomed. We ride buses, trains, and cars across, over, and under concrete plains. Being Indian has never been about returning to the land. The land is everywhere or nowhere. So that's the end of the prologue. Another character that happened the first year, his name is Dean Oxendine, and the premise to his chapter and for his position in the book is that he's making a documentary about Native people living in Oakland. So like, how did they end up in Oakland? How long have they been there? What's life like to be, and what's it like to be Native in Oakland? I'm just gonna read a little bit from this, but he goes in front of a nonprofit panel for a cultural arts grant, and I did this before I started writing the book. Or like maybe concurrent with writing the book at the beginning. And so a lot of this came from my own experience, but then it diverges because he got the grant, I got the grant, he got $5,000, he started doing the project. I never did the project, it was just the book, and it was a way to supplement my income. And I apologize to them at the end of the book for only doing the fictional version of the project they gave me a lot of money for. Dean Oxendine takes the dead escalator two steps at a time at the Fruitvale station. When he makes it up to the platform, the train he thought he was missing comes to a stop on the opposite side. A single drop of sweat drips down the side of his face from out of his beanie. Dean wipes the sweat with his finger, then pulls the beanie off and shakes it out, mad like the sweat came from it and not his head. He looks down the tracks and breathes out a breath he watches rise then disappear. He smells cigarette smoke, which makes him want one, except they tire him out. He wants a cigarette that invigorates. He wants a drug that works. He refuses to drink, smokes too much weed. Nothing works. Dean looks across the tracks at graffiti scrawled on the wall in a little crawl space underneath the platform. He'd been seeing it for years all over Oakland. He'd thought of the name in middle school, but had never really done anything with it. Lens. The first time Dean saw someone tag, he was on the bus. It was raining. The kid was in the back. Dean saw that the kid saw that Dean looked back at him. One of the first things Dean learned when he first started taking the bus in Oakland was that you don't stare, you don't even glance, but you don't totally not look either. Out of respect, you acknowledge. You look and don't look. Anything to avoid the question, what you looking at? There is no good answer for this question. Being asked this question means you already fucked up. Dean waited for his moment, watched the kid tag, and the condensation on the bus window, three letters, EMT. He understood right away that it meant empty, and he liked the idea that the kid was writing it in the condensation on the window in the empty space between drops, and also because it wouldn't last, just like tagging and graffiti don't. The head of the train, then its body appear, wind around the bend toward the station. Self-loathing hits you fast sometimes. He doesn't know for a second if he might jump, get down there on the tracks, wait for that fast weight to come get rid of him. He'd probably jump late, bounce off the side of the train, and just fuck up his face. On the train, he thinks of the looming panel of judges. He keeps picturing them 20 feet up, staring down at him with long, wild faces in the style of Ralph Steadman, old white men, all noses and robes. They'll know everything about him. Hate him intimately, with all the possible knowledge about his life available to them. They'll see immediately how unqualified he is. They'll think he's white, which is only half true, and so ineligible for a cultural arts grant. Dean is not recognizably Native. He is ambiguously non-white. Over the years, he'd been assumed Mexican plenty, been asked if he was Chinese, Korean, Japanese, Salvadoran once, but mostly the question came like this: what are you? Everyone on the train is looking at their phones, into them. He smells piss and at first thinks it's him. He's always feared he'll find out that he smelled like piss and shit his whole life without knowing it, that everyone's been afraid to tell him. Like Kevin Farley from the fifth grade, who ended up killing himself the summer of their junior year in high school when he found out. He looks to his left and sees an old man slumped down in his seat. The old guy comes to and sits up straight, then moves his arms around like he's checking to make sure all his stuff is still with him, even though there's nothing there. Dean walks to the next train car. He stands at the doors and looks out the window. The train floats alongside the freeway next to cars. Each of their speeds is different. The speed of the cars is short, disconnected, sporadic. Dean and the train slither along the tracks as one movement in speed. There's something cinematic about their variable speeds, like a moment in a movie that makes you feel something for reasons you can't explain. Something too big to feel underneath and inside, too familiar to recognize, right there in front of you at all times. Dean puts his headphones on, shuffles the music on his phone, skips several songs, and stays on "There, There" by Radiohead. The hook is "just because you feel it doesn't mean it's there." Before going underground between the Fruitvale and Lake Merritt stations, Dean looks over and sees the word, that name again, "Lens," there in the wall, right before he goes under. So this last part is from the same grant that I referenced. We took the youth to Alcatraz, and we got elders who had been there during the occupation. And the writing of this novel from, so I don't know if you all know, but Native people took over Alcatraz from like 1969 to late 1971, I believe. We were able to get in contact with people that were there, and we had them tell stories to the youth. And while I was there, I couldn't help but wonder what it would have been like to be a child, because a lot of activist parents brought their children over and they lived there and they slept in the cells. So instead of writing sort of like a triumphant narrative about how we resisted the US government and temporarily took over a prison island, I thought, what would it have been like for kids? And coming from crazy idealist parents myself, I felt very much more attuned to what that experience would have been like as opposed to a sort of righteous activist thing. So this character, who's a central character in the novel, Opal Viola Victoria Bearshield, her mom just sort of abruptly takes her sisters there, and she brings her teddy bear Two Shoes. And where I'm reading from, her mom has just told her to go find her sister because she's running around with teens on the island. And she brings her teddy bear with her because she's sort of scared to go out there and find her sister alone. I found them by the shore closest to the Golden Gate. They were all over the rocks, pointing at each other and laughing in that wild, cruel way teenagers have about them. I told Two Shoes it probably wasn't such a good idea and that we should just go back. "Sister, you don't have to worry. All these people, even these young ones over here, they're all our relatives, so don't be scared. Plus, if anyone comes after you, I'll jump down and bite their ankles. They would never expect that. I'll use my sacred bear medicine on them. It'll put them to sleep. It'll be like instantaneous hibernation. That's what I'll do, sister, so don't worry. Creator made me strong to protect you," Two Shoes said. I told Two Shoes to stop talking like an Indian. "I don't know what you mean by talking like an Indian," he said. "You're not an Indian, T.S. You're a teddy bear. You know, we're not so different. Both of us got our names from pig-brained men." Pig brain? Men with pigs for brains. Oh, meaning Columbus called you Indians. For us, it was Teddy Roosevelt's fault. How? He was hunting bear one time, but then found this real scraggly old hungry bear, and he refused to shoot it. Then in the newspapers, there was a comic about that hunting story that made it seem like Mr. Roosevelt was merciful, a real nature lover, that kind of thing. Then they made the little stuffed bear and named it Teddy's Bear. Teddy's Bear became Teddy Bear. What they didn't say was that he slit that old bear's throat. It's that kind of mercy they don't want you to know about. And how do you know about any of this? You gotta know about the history of your people, how you got to be here. That's all based on what people done to get you here. Us bears, you Indians, we've been through a lot. They tried to kill us. But then when you hear them tell it, they make history seem like one big heroic adventure across an empty forest. There were bears and Indians all over the place. Sister, they slit all our throats. Why do I feel like Mom told us this already? I said. Roosevelt said, I don't go so far as to think that the only good Indians are dead Indians, but I believe 9 out of every 10 are, and I shouldn't like to inquire too closely into the case of the 10th. Damn, T.S., that's messed up. I only heard the one about the big stick. That big stick is the lie about mercy. Speak softly and carry a big stick. That's what he said about foreign policy. That's what they used on us, bears and Indians both, foreigners on our own land. And with their big sticks, they marched us so far west we almost disappeared. And Two Shoes went quiet. That's the way it was with him. He either had something to say or he didn't. I could tell by what kind of shine I saw in the black of his eyes which one it was. I put Two Shoes behind some rocks and headed down to my sister. Thank you.
Debut novelist Tommy Orange there, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I'm Peter Biello, and when we return, Orange sits down with me for an interview for this edition of Writers on a New England Stage.
NHPR Summer Car Raffle is back, and now's the time to get your early bird tickets. Don't miss your chance to win three $2,000 gas gift cards to any station of your choice, not to mention the grand prize, $25,000 toward a new car. Get your tickets today, one for $50 or get six for $150 at nhpr.org. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Edvest and You, a local New Hampshire nonprofit specializing in college student loans and student refinancing options. Information online at nhstudentloans.org. Hazy sunshine, hot, humid today, high temperatures, upper 80s to lower 90s. It'll cloud up tonight, overnight lows mid-60s to around 70 degrees. For tomorrow, cloudy, afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Some storms could have some gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs tomorrow in the mid to upper 80s. And mostly sunny Sunday, highs upper 70s to lower 80s. This is NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with Tommy Orange, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. I spoke with Orange about his early inspirations for his novel There, There, and we took questions from the audience. Well, Tommy Orange, thank you very much for being here for Writers on a New England Stage. We really appreciate it.
Happy to be here. Thank you for having me.
The book is incredible. We'll talk a lot about the book, but first I wanted to start by talking about you and your life a little bit. In the book, you have depictions of young boys hanging out, doing things young boys do, various levels of parental supervision. And I wanted to ask you about your childhood and being young. Was that kind of how it was like for you?
Yeah, the things that my parents did, they should be tried for.
Explain. What did they do?
I should say that they didn't do.
But they didn't do.
We just were allowed free reign of like parts of Oakland that were not, they're even worse. I mean, they're better now, but they were not great then. But I think a lot of people experience that. It's a different time period, it's a different mind frame for parenting, where helicoptering became normal, and horrors of, you know, child abduction and molestation became a little more normal in the news cycle. And so I understand why we who are parents now are more paranoid. So I don't seriously judge my parents for it, but we really were allowed to roam the streets of Oakland as much as we wanted.
Mm-hmm. Have you found that to be a good thing for your writing now? You have that experience to draw on?
I mean, nothing bad happened, so it's good now that I'm still alive. And yeah, sure, some of those experiences definitely informed my characters.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to ask a question that was submitted by someone in the audience. Not really a question, but I guess a statement. I'd love you to hear your thoughts on it. The statement is, this book gave me permission for the first time in my life to be a biracial person who looks completely white. I can't tell you how much it means to me to understand how very many people are like me. What do you think of that audience member's comment?
Yeah, it's a hard road for the ambiguously non-white or the ambiguously white or the non-ambiguous white who are biracial. There's this whole like middle section of coming from different cultures and ethnic backgrounds that you know, the society wants to name and categorize as fast as possible and not have to deal with it. And often that's like white dominant culture who wants to do that. But then even from specific cultural backgrounds, it stings especially more when you're considered white by the people you're from, even if you're half. You know, one of my characters in the book claims that like I'm as native as Obama is black. And we have the first black president, and like we have characters that are half the exact same amount that he's black, who feel like they can't claim their native identity. And largely this has to do with, and this is true of other cultures, but with native cultures, because our population is so low and because there's a monolithic image of what we're supposed to look like that's sort of crushed the rest of us. Because our population's so low and we don't know what the spectrum of what native people look like, if we don't look a certain way, then we're not native. But like a person from Alaska whose skin is much more pale than other native tribes because of where they live looks a lot different than somebody from southern Florida who might be a Seminole, both experientially and facial structure and skin tone. Like our range of what we look like is a huge spectrum. And the fact that most people don't know that is related to lower population, which is related to massive genocide and disease and all the things that come with history. But it's especially painful when you're not allowed to be the thing you are. For such insidious reasons, and because not only because of what happened in history, but the way that we've been, like, if we're not this certain type of Indian, probably wearing feathers, maybe a big nose. They just got rid of the Cleveland Indians ridiculous caricature, by the way, which should be celebrated a little bit.
Your character, as you just read a moment ago, encountered the question, what are you? And I wanted to ask you if you've encountered that question, and if you have, what goes through your mind when you get a question like that?
I think it's a kind of a normal question in Oakland because there's so many biracial families. On the block that I grew up on, every single family that I knew, every single friend that I had, and there was like seven different friends my age that I had, we were all biracial. So it wasn't necessarily always offensive. It was worse when I was mistaken for something else in a So in high school, I was called Chinese racial slurs, and I played hockey and I was called Mexican racial slurs. I was never once called Native racial slurs, and I sort of wanted to be in a weird way. Just once to feel the specific rage that goes along with that.
One more question about your childhood. Who, if anybody, told you stories when you were a child?
My dad was pretty reticent when growing up. We didn't really grow up in a reading family or a storytelling family. There were certain stories that my dad told about his childhood, and there was a massacre narrative that I thought was a massacre narrative for the longest time, because it's about the Sand Creek Massacre, which is a big part of Cheyenne history, that I only recently realized was my dad's naming story. So it wasn't like his morbid sort of curiosity or, you know, we have to remember what happened to us thing. It's like, this is how he got his Indian name. And it's related to a young boy saving one of our relatives. And an old tradition was to exchange names if you save somebody's life. So the story that I grew up, like the gruesome story about a massacre of mostly women, children, and elders, was really just how he got his name.
Wow. What was it like to hear that kind of story at such a young age?
I couldn't process it then. I think, you know, knowing when I got older, like, I've heard this story the most of any other story. It definitely carries a weight with it.
Mm-hmm. At what point in your life did you discover that you really wanted to tell stories or be a novelist?
It was after... It's a story of sinking ships. So roller hockey was my first dream of the thing I wanted to do. So in the 90s, in Oakland, it was a professional sport. They're the Oakland Skates. They played where the Warriors play now, and we would go to games, and it seemed like if I worked hard, it was a reasonable thing that would happen. And I played for like the junior team, or the equivalent of the junior team for that sport, and I got sponsored by a company. They gave me equipment, like, everything seemed like that could happen. And then at the end of the 90s, early 2000s, everyone was like, rollerblading's really dorky. And everyone put their rollerblades in their closet, or they sold them or just threw them in the garbage. And the sport died. This is just a fact, and my dream did. And I became a musician, and I was like out of high school, which I didn't have a good time in high school, but I became a musician. So I was never a reader. Roller hockey was the thing. Became a musician, and then I went to school for sound engineering. And I happened to go during this. So sinking ship number one was roller blading and roller hockey. So I became a sound engineer, or I went to school for it. And this was right 2003 to 2004. And most of my education there was analog recording. And this timed perfectly with the MP3 taking over the world and analog recording becoming obsolete as a skill to know. And so I graduated and it was like, oh. So sinking ship number two. And I got a job at East Bookstore, and I was just reading philosophy and religion because I'm like, I don't know what to do. And I sort of stumbled into fiction. Like, I think she hired me because she needed to consolidate two big warehouses of books into one, and she could tell I could probably carry some books. And so I just sort of like fell in love with fiction by accident. But once I knew, I was completely convinced, and that was when it was like 2004, 2005 is when I knew that's what I wanted to do.
Mm-hmm. And what novelists were you reading that made you say, wow, this is something I really want to try to do myself?
Well, Kafka and Borges were the sort of bridge from philosophy and religion to fiction. But the two novels that I remember like really making me know that I wanted to write a novel were, so I was on a break from the bookstore and I was eating a donut and I was reading Confederacy of Dunces. And the way that he mixes sadness and humor and philosophy and how like weird the whole novel is as an endeavor, like as a structure, I just loved, I didn't know that was a thing. Like, I didn't read, I didn't care about school. And then Sylvia Plath's Bell Jar was also another one. Also infused with sadness. They both committed suicide. That's not what I was into, but I think part of their despair and them being able to turn it into sort of this artful form and this medium was a draw for me.
Mm-hmm. Well, this is a really, I mean, as we know, right, this is a very heavy book, as books like The Bell Jar, of course, are as well. How did you decide on the structure of there? Because some of these stories, I mean, it would not be a stretch to imagine that this is also kind of a short story collection, but because they're linked, it's definitely a novel, but some of these stories can stand on their own. How do you imagine the structure here?
So I thought of the idea for the novel, and I sort of knew the ending. I knew all the lives would converge at the end. That gives me sort of a cheat, like I know what to do in all the stories. I have to figure out a way how they get there. And then how they're all connected was a lot trickier, and that's sort of what informed the structure. But while I was writing it, I just like multivocality in as a reader, and so I wanted to try to do it as a writer. If I knew how messy and it would get, or it ended up getting, and how much self-doubt and uncertainty in the middle of writing it I would have had to go through, I probably would have like tried to do a linear one-person novel, maybe like a crime story or something.
But was it also fun to get to switch around and embody this perspective and then that perspective and then zoom out in the prologue and the interlude? Was that fun?
I don't think fun is it would ever be one of the words.
Well, you always hope novelists are having fun, right? Because you can't imagine it's going to be for money, right? So you just sit down and enjoy yourself, but I guess
well,
not.
Well, enjoyment could be closer.
Okay.
it's what I wanted to do. Like, I feel fulfilled. I especially like writing new things. And this was like the first year, and I think everything's great that I'm writing, and then I go back to it, and it's horrible. So the not fun part is like getting it to a place where you do feel good about it. That's the big chunk of not fun time. So there's like a little fun, and then not fun work. And then like when you get it to a place where you feel like it's in a good place, it's fulfilling for sure. I'm writing short stories now, and I do actually feel like I'm having fun because I don't have to worry about a superstructure, and the stories can go in any direction, and that does feel like fun.
Mm-hmm. And so your next book, will that be a collection of short stories?
Yeah.
Yeah, that must be nice.
Yeah.
A nice change of pace. We had a question from the audience about the ending. The question is, how do you respond to people who say the book is too sad or the ending too cruel? I guess we might warn the audience to say now that permission to have spoilers. Is that okay?
Oh, wait.
I don't know. Maybe not.
Wait. Before you keep going, we're not in spoiler territory yet.
Okay.
This is still interpretation.
Certainly.
And that's where I'm going to go with it. So this reaction of too sad has been isolated to a very specific reader. So I haven't had a single native person come up to me and talk to me about the ending and it being sad. I actually feel like native people come up to me with a kind of exuberance for being represented and for doing it right and doing it in a contemporary way and telling a story that we don't get represented very well in. You know, we're so often historical. Even movies and books that are coming out now, it's all historical. So I wrote this thing to be purposefully feeling like right now and contemporary and interfacing with technology. And so sadness does not necessarily, this could be the reader, you can't say it's objectively sad. This is, there's elements of tragedy. But I tried to infuse hope in it also. So it's not a spoiler. That's a specific reader.
Okay. I'll leave out some details from certain questions. Anyway. And I did want to ask about pardon me. I did want to ask about the prologue and then the interlude, because those are two things that you don't see too often in novels. And I can imagine editors or maybe colleagues in your MFA program, for example, saying, ditch the prologue, ditch the interlude. You don't need this. Just show us what the characters are doing and let us make up our own minds about it. I think it works, and I enjoyed that part, and I see why it works, but I'm wondering how you
I could say
think that, yes, this is necessary,
conceptually,
and then fought
I
to make
thought
it work.
Of the whole structure, and I had enough confidence to be like, this is what I want to do. That's not what happened. I knew I wanted to write a prologue because I like the way prologues function in novels and how they can sort of do their own weird thing before the story begins. So I had a 14-page prologue, and my editor was like, nope.
Nope, because it's too long?
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I cut it in half, and I put it in the other half in the middle, and I said, this is an interlude. And then they loved the idea. So that, you know, that actually came from an editor saying, like, too long prologue, but she loved the interlude. And these mini chapters, I had been toying around with this idea because we visit all these characters and we're about to visit new ones. So the interlude serves as a stopping point. And then we get these mini chapters where you're reminded of who we've already visited before we move on to new characters. And then by the time we get to the end, the whole thing's full of mini chapters that references all the characters. Mm-hmm. So the structure was born out of partly the editors saying no, and me working with that and trying to figure out a way to make it work in a way that's friendlier to the reader.
That's Native American novelist Tommy Orange and our conversation recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage. Stay with us for more from my conversation with Tommy Orange. That's coming up after this quick break.
Lawmakers visit detainees at the border and leave appalled and angry.
Fix the damn thing. Like, what are we talking about here? You're the president of the United States. Go down there, fix it.
Washington's National Day of Celebration turns swampy, and America's World Cup winning women are through to the final again. It's the Friday News Roundup, next time on 1A.
That's This Morning at 10 here on NHPR. Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and from Plymouth State University, where a graduate degree is only the beginning of a new career path. More at plymouth.edu/grad. Hazy sunshine, hot and humid for today. High temperatures upper 80s to lower 90s. Clouding up tonight with overnight lows mid-60s to around 70 degrees. Tomorrow, cloudy, some afternoon showers and thunderstorms. Some storms could have some gusty winds and heavy rainfall. Highs tomorrow, mid to upper 80s. This is NHPR.
I'm Peter Biello, and this is Writers on a New England Stage with author Tommy Orange, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth. Writers on a New England Stage, by the way, a co-production of NHPR and the Music Hall. Here's Tommy Orange reflecting on his feelings of self-doubt as an emerging writer and how his book, There, There, finally broke through. Can you talk a little bit about this book's path to publication?
So I decided I wanted to write in 2005. I wanted to write just in general. I knew I had a lot of work to do to catch up to people who, precocious kids who were reading when they were three, when I was watching TV. And so from 2005 to like 2014, it was all just on my own, writing and reading as much as I could. I quit my job two different times and moved away to the country, different, like to New Mexico and to Oregon. And like waited tables and just did that. But I got into this MFA program, and I knew it was the Institute of American Indian Arts where I teach now. I liked the faculty, and it was low residency, it was affordable. I also knew that part of the value of an MFA is you're making relationships with people who have access to the publishing world. And if they think your writing is good, or if you come out with a good manuscript, you can get access. Like, I knew that was a possibility. So that ended up happening. One of my teachers was going to send it to her editor at Norton, just straight to her editor. And so I tightened up my manuscript and worked really hard for like 2 months and then sent it away and then heard nothing. And I figured, like, oh, okay, it's what I've always thought it was, bad. And I went to this conference, this writing conference, and another writer heard, I was a fellow there, and another writer heard me read 7 minutes from the book. And she said, send me your manuscript. I want to send this to my agent. And I didn't know who her agent was. The idea of getting an agent sounded amazing. But then heard nothing. And once again, just like, you know, it just affirmed my own self-doubt. And then Trump got in. And the very next day, her and her husband both, so literary people can only do so much. They took it as a call to action, and they both sent my manuscript to their respective agents. And 3 nights later, my now agent was up with anxiety. She's Arab and English, and she wanted to leave the country because her mom was sick, and she wasn't sure if she'd get back in. So she was up with anxiety at 4 a.m. and reading from the different manuscripts that had been sent to her. And she said that my manuscript gave her hope, and in this like very dark time after he'd been elected. And I'm not trying to give too much, you know, credit to Trump, but it's very much, the success of the book is definitely situated within a certain cultural climate and a political time. And so she signed me the next day. And she sold the book to publishers with the 14-page prologue. Like, that was what she thought was the strongest thing to sell, largely because of the political time that it was situated in. I'm not trying to undercut myself too much, but it is, you know, every book exists within its time to some extent. And so there was a whole bidding war, and it went to Knopf, and it was a very strange moment where I got a call from Sarah Jessica Parker.
Tell us about that. Set the scene for us. Where were you?
So I woke up on a Friday before the Tuesday where it was going to go to auction, and I got a text from my agent saying, this is going to be the strangest text I've ever sent, but Sarah Jessica Parker wants to talk to you. And so, you know, I'd just woken up, and I was like, it's one of these moments where I'm like, okay, this is going to be an interesting dream fact to tell my wife when I wake up. The day went on and I never woke up, and I'm at a coffee shop sort of waiting for this phone call to happen. And you know, I talked to her editor, and she's very gracious and really wants the book. And ultimately, between me and my agent and other people that I was talking to at the time, we just decided to go to auction instead. And she was starting a literary imprint under Hogarth, which is under Penguin Random House. There's this whole system of like these giant, like Penguin Random House type publishers that have like 10,000 imprints under them. This is part of like what happened with record labels and all these corporations swallowing all these other businesses and becoming giants with, anyway.
Is that, just as a side note, like, is that a good thing, a good sign for the publishing industry that someone like Sarah Jessica Parker wants to get in on it?
Pass? I don't know. I mean, her using her sort of star power to promote literary works is a wonderful thing. And I'm friends with someone whose book she acquired, and it's a terrific book. Mm-hmm. So
I want to ask you about your teaching work. What do you tell your students, or what do you teach to your students to help them become the best writer they can possibly be?
I try to work with deconstructing authority being a big part of the MFA? Because you're working with people who have published books, and that automatically comes with like, oh, these people have made it sort of feelings. And as a young writer, when you're trying to develop your own voice, you're going to listen to people who have published books as the authority on what a good sentence is or what a good idea for writing is. And there's a lot of schools of thought around what makes good writing, and none of them are exactly right. There are tools you can give for people to put in their toolboxes, but there is no authority on like, this is good writing and this isn't. There are different ways to think about sentences and structures of short stories or novels. So I try to get them to like move past a lot of what comes with working with published authors as teachers to retain the originality of their own natural voices. That's one of the main things that I try to do.
Mm-hmm. And how do you recognize when a student is not doing that? Like what signs do they show?
I can't see it, because when I work with them, I very much deconstruct everything that I say to sort of include that. So I don't know when they go to other teachers, I don't know how much, I don't know if it's working. This is just what I'm trying to do.
We got a question about spiders. Can you talk a little bit about, from the audience, can you talk a little bit about spiders in the leg? How is that real? How does that happen? And what significance does that have? I think we get another question about spiders too, just to demonstrate how important these spiders are to some audience members.
So there is, yeah, there's a spider theme, several characters, but the symbolism of the spider legs, I can't really say that's necessarily a thing that I was doing. I just pulled two spider legs out of my leg, is how it ended up in the book with the characters. In 2012 or 13, I pulled two spider legs out of my leg and scoured the internet like the characters do in the book and couldn't find anything.
Now, are you saying like literal spider legs?
I
or things
literally
that
pulled
like spider legs?
Two spider legs out of my leg.
Okay.
There was a bump on my leg and it sort of got more pokey. And then I pulled at those pokes and one leg came out and I put it on tissue paper and another one came out and I went to my wife and I didn't know what to say and there was blood and so we scoured the internet, wanted to know what was wrong, and it seemed like an Indian thing to me. So I called my dad and I was like, have you heard of this? What is this? And he said, sounds to me like he got witched. And I was like, Well, what do we do? And he said, I'll pray for you. That's it.
And you're fine.
And that's it. And that's, so I had a spider theme, and I have a spider structure, sort of spider web structure to the novel, because these connections start, you know, in a spider web, like it's wider and the connection gets closer and closer, and the climax is when it's closest, which is the end. So the structure of the novel is a spider web. And Jackie Redfeather's character has this thing about how a spider's web is both home and a trap. And she relates this to addiction and other things. So it's a trap for other, anyway. Mm-hmm. So I didn't know what to do with it and it freaked me out. So I thought, well, if I can't do anything with it, I should just give it to my characters, because it seems like something.
There is much made of your book. Apart from the glowing reviews, the Paris Review has remarked, for example, that with Sherman Alexie facing sexual harassment allegations, he's sort of being pushed aside now, and since he's dominated for so long, making room for people like you. I didn't know your thoughts on that, on feeling like now there is room for someone like you to come and be a new voice for the community.
Well, I would hope that the room is not for me, but for a kind of us. I've certainly gotten a lot of attention and the book's selling really well, but I like to promote other Native authors There's a lot of amazing writing happening right now in the Native world, and I would certainly never want to be like the replacement for him. So, you know, I try to blurb people's books and promote when I'm asked to write things about what to recommend, or when people ask me, I try to have at least a few books. It's a really a question that I'm really bad at answering, but I try my best to like have some books in mind to recommend, to deflect the idea that there's such a thing as Native American voice, because there's 576 federally recognized tribes and a bunch more that aren't recognized for bad reasons. And these are all individual languages and worldviews and different styles of writing and different experiences in life. And the very premise of there being a Native American voice is flawed. So I try not to think in those terms as much as I can.
So you said you're working on short stories now. Will these short stories also be exploring aspects of contemporary Native American life?
Yeah, I feel like it's sort of an inseparable part of my writing process. Basically, like if I'm not writing through my experience, if I sort of have a narrator that never references where that narrator comes from, it's automatically a white man. Like, women have had to do this for a long time. If you just write like a general narrator, because of the history of literature, everyone thinks of a white man. So you sort of, it's a burden, and it can be clumsy to try to have to include it, but you do have to include it for it to be a representative voice from the specific place that you're coming from, that you're writing from. So I try to find ways to do it in ways that are interesting that are exciting to me. Like, the story that I was referencing that I finished at McDowell is written from a 13-year-old boy who's asked to write a letter to Amerigo Vespucci, who's America's namesake. And he was like a very mediocre, like not a very good navigator. And he was a pimp and a jeweler and like a banker. And he's very much representative of the American spirit. But this little boy is like sort of, he knows his mom's Native and his dad's like half Italian, half French, and he's sort of like has some anger at Amerigo and has an experience with a bully, and he like calls Amerigo like a pirate, which he calls a boat criminal, and he's like equating him to the bully, and this whole drama plays out. So, you know, it's included, but it's doing it in totally different ways than the novel was doing it.
Well, fans of There, There, I think, are already looking forward to reading that. I certainly am. Tommy Orange, thank you very much for speaking with me.
Yes,
I really appreciate
you.
It. That's Tommy Orange, recorded live at the Music Hall in Portsmouth for Writers on a New England Stage, a co-production of New Hampshire Public Radio and the Music Hall. The executive producer and live stage presentation director is Patricia Lynch. Producer and literary coordinator is Brittany Wasson. The live sound and recording and mixing engineer is Ian Martin. Bob Lord and Dreadnought provide live music. Broadcast producer for NHPR is Emily Quirk. Music Hall production manager is Jana Morris. Photos from the event by David J. Murray are posted online at cleareyephoto.com. I'm Peter Biello, and this has been a special broadcast from New Hampshire Public Radio.
This is NHPR. I'm Dan Kogan. Good morning. 1A is next at 10 o'clock.
Hey, this is Nick Capodice.
I'm Hannah McCarthy. And starting this week, Civics 101 is going back to basics with our Starter Kit series.
6 episodes that will allow you to listen to any other episode with confidence and an understanding of the whole system.
We'll go through the 3 branches, executive, legislative, and judicial.
And checks and balances, how a bill really becomes a law, and federalism.
Subscribe and download at civics101podcast.org or wherever you get your favorite audio.
Support for NHPR comes from you, our listeners, and the Circus Mercus Big Top Tour coming to Keene July 15th and 16th and Hanover July 18th, 19th, and 20th. Smirkus.org. Hazy sunshine, hot, humid today, high temperatures upper 80s to lower 90s. It'll cloud up tonight, lows mid-60s to around 70 degrees. This is NHPR.
These are the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio.
WEVO, Concord, 89.1.
WEVS, Nashua, 88.3.
WEVH, Hanover, 91.3.
WEVN, Keene, 90.7.
WEVC, Gorham, 107.1.
WEVJ, Jackson, 99.5.
WEVF, Colebrook, 90.3.
And WEVQ, Littleton, 91.9.
And online at nhpr.org.